You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. Serious talk about the sacred book. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Bible for Normal People. And today, Jared, we're going to talk about our hero.
I thought you were my hero.
Yeah,
we're talking
true.
About you today?
No, I'm talking about Goliath. Goliath is my hero.
Oh.
And David. David and Goliath. No, that story that we know so well. One of the most abused stories in the Bible, I think.
Abused? That's strong words.
It is, but I think along with like the Daniel story, because dare to be a Daniel. Those are the famous sermons of people here growing up, like be brave like Daniel or be brave like David against obstacles, against bigger things, you know, and that's sort of how that story is usually presented to children. The thing is that when you read it, it's not really about that very much. It's not about a little guy against the odds beats the big guy because he trusts God. It's like most things in the Bible, right? It's a lot more interesting. It's a lot more complicated. And the characters are thicker. You know, they're multidimensional, not this two-dimensional thing.
Yeah. And it kind of couches that. Like when we get into the story, there's some biblical challenges, and it highlights some of the things we've talked about before on the podcast, but I think we also have to wrap it up in, you know, one of the phrases we hear a lot when we talk about David is that he was a man after God's own heart, and that's also a little questionable here.
Yeah.
And so just kind of being able to think about what are the implications of how the Bible records, and you know, for me, I think it's when I read the story of David closely, and if you read it with a serious intent, kind of word by word, and you can take out sort of the ways you heard it in those Sunday school settings, it just paints a very different picture. I mean, the Bible itself paints a different picture of David than maybe we've thought about it.
Right, and that's important to remember that it's not about, hey, let's take down the story kind of thing. It's like, right. No, let's actually read it and ask ourselves the question, like, what are they trying to say back then? And not, how would I like to take it to find a story from the Bible that encourages me to do X, Y, and Z? You know, we're really not reading these stories for their purposes, what they were written for. And like I said, there's a lot, it's really interesting and sort of like, oh gosh, seriously? You have these uh-oh moments and aha moments reading the story of David and seeing things that are there that are actually planted there to make you think. And not just to sort of accept, okay, who's the good guy and who's the bad guy? Sort of everybody's a little bit of a bad guy.
Yeah, maybe let's paint this picture. I'd like to maybe paint it in this kind of Sunday school way. I can give kind of the summary if I can go back to those memories. And then let's maybe look at some of the discrepancies in the story.
Okay.
And kind of jump in from there.
Let's talk microdosing, as you'd expect from a Bible podcast. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good.
And you know, microdose gummies are good for so many things like anxiety, workflow, sleeping, and stuff like that. I mean, Jared, we've had people in our lives that have benefited from this too, not just us.
Yeah, I have a family member who regularly uses microdosing for more creative, like recreational time, a time they journal every night and it's sort of a way to unwind and do the journaling. And that's worked really well for them.
Our producer. It's made such a difference, folks. I can't even tell you that. So anyway, and for me as well, microdose gummies helped me a lot with anxiety and sleep and just stopping that racing mind at night. And it helps tremendously. I get a good night's sleep. So get 30% off your first order plus free shipping today at microdose.com. Promo code normal people. It's available nationwide.
That's microdose.com, promo code normal people for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code normal people.
So what for me, and you can have your own version of this story, but for me, David and Goliath really was, and this is also helpful for people who maybe haven't read that story in a long time, is we have the way I would have had it. So there's no historical accuracy or even biblical accuracy with what I'm going to say. I'm just going to kind of riff off what I heard in Sunday school, which was there's this little kid, David.
Who had magic superpowers.
No, that's Marvel. You're getting way extra biblical here.
Eh, whatever.
No, so there's this little kid, David, and there is a scaredy cat king, Saul. Saul and the Israelites can't stand up to this giant named Goliath, the Philistine champion, who is fighting against the Israelites. And here is David, who trusts God more than he's scratching his head saying, well, if we have God on our side, why are you scared of this Goliath guy? And he was really just there to bring his older more battle-tested brothers some dinner or lunch. And they're all talking about this Goliath, and he says, okay, who is this guy? Oh, well, you know, God's on our side, so why are we afraid? You know, suit me up. I'm going to go out there, and I don't need a sword. I don't need anything. I just need my slingshot.
Put me in, coach.
And I'm going to go take my slingshot. And he kind of winds up, smacks Goliath in the forehead. Goliath dies. The Philistines are dispersed, and David wins the day.
Yeah. So be like David.
Be brave like David. Right.
Don't look at the odds. So.
Okay. So let's dig into that a little.
Yeah. When you look at it a little more closely, I think there are two basic like categories of things we can look at. One is what the story says, sort of in between the lines a little bit about David's character, that it's more complex than just he's a nice guy, and also just some discrepancies or oddities in the story that have made people curious for a very long time. So. One of the character things is, you know, we remember that the king before David is Saul. Well, the king during this story is Saul. David's not a king. And Saul is described as somebody, like when he comes onto the scene in chapter 9, 1 Samuel chapter 9, he comes on the scene and he's described as being, you know, there wasn't anybody like him in Israel that was more handsome than he. And he stood head and shoulders above everyone else. So he's very tall and he's very handsome. And okay, that's interesting because biblical writers don't really describe people very often, hardly at all. Like, what does Moses look like? What does Abraham look like? Who cares? So when somebody's being described, something's going on. You got to pay attention to that. And it turns out that, you know, Saul, long story short, doesn't work out. He's a horrible king. He is basically just, you know, a disaster that happens. And so God tells Samuel. He anointed. He's a prophet and a priest and a judge, and he anointed Saul. But now God says, yeah, we're done with Saul. I have somebody else in mind. Go to the house of Jesse. And this brings us now to the introduction of David in chapter 16. And Samuel goes to the house of Jesse, and he says, okay, well, bring me your son. So his eldest comes to him. His name is Eliab. And Samuel says, surely this has got to be the king. Look at this guy. You know, he's wonderful. But then God breaks in and says, listen, we made this mistake once before. You know, God doesn't look at the outside of a person. God looks at the heart. Don't look at their appearance. Their appearance is not going to be a judge of how well they're going to do. So it's not him. And then it sort of goes through the line to the next son, the third son, the fourth, the fifth, sixth. And none of them are God's choice for king until finally Samuel says, do you have anybody else? And Jesse goes, well, there's David. Yeah, but he's out in the field tending the sheep. And he says, well, bring him in. He goes, well, that's the guy. And right there, see, this is one of these little subtle things in the story. This is in 1 Samuel 16 and verse 12. He sent and brought him, David, in. Now, he was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. Why are they telling us that? You just got done telling us that God doesn't look at somebody's appearance, and that word handsome is the same word. It's just the word tov in Hebrew, which means good. It's a pretty generic word. But this is the same way that Saul is described. So right there, as soon as you're introduced to David, you're looking at his physical description and you're saying, how is this guy going to do? You know, is he going to be Saul, or is he going to be a better king than Saul is? And if you know how the story goes, David becomes a morally very sort of a corrupted character. You know, get the whole Bathsheba thing, right, Jared? Yeah, and some other things too, yeah. So there he is. He's mentioned, you know, his appearance is mentioned. And his appearance comes up again in the David and Goliath story, 1742, about him being ruddy and handsome. And again, it's one of these things that just, it makes you stop and think, because David's the last person you'd expect to be given a physical description, given what God just said like four verses earlier.
So what does that mean for you when you read that and say, why are those standing next to each other? What's the writer of Samuel trying to say by giving this physical description?
Well, I think there are two options. One is that David is described as ruddy and handsome, like red-cheeked, sort of youthful, which for some people means, well, that means that he's actually not at all like Saul. He has a totally different look about him. He looks like a little kid, right? So in other words, this could be positive, it could be a way of contrasting David to Saul. On the other hand, he's ruddy, had beautiful eyes, okay, whatever that means, and he was handsome. See, that same word that describes Saul. So the physical description of David is already full of like ambiguities. It's you don't know what to conclude about David based on the description. It could go either way. You got to wait and read the rest of the story to see where it goes. But you're already being introduced to something that you've got to think through. And I think that's just why biblical narrative is so interesting. It's actually not sort of flat and simplistic and story-like. They're trying to – it's layered and they're trying to make you think of stuff.
Yeah, that seems – you know, you can correct me here, but in 1 Samuel 17, when Goliath sees David, it says, and he disdained him, and then kind of has this kind of reason there. Yeah. He disdained him because he was young. He was a youth. He was ruddy. Like, but then that ruddy and handsome, it's like, well, is that part of the reason that he disdained him? Like, are there three reasons? Because he was youth, he was ruddy, and he was handsome.
Yeah.
Or is it because he was a youth, and then you're just kind of adding this ruddy and handsome there to, right, again, make this kind of Saul connection?
Right. Yeah. And that's – and this is – you know, sometimes biblical narrative is ambiguous, and I believe that oftentimes it's intentionally ambiguous because it's not just going to lay the goods out for you. You've got to think about what's happening in the story.
So, you know, you started this by saying there's some things about David's character, and I think in future podcasts, hopefully, there's way more to David's character issues than just what we have here. This is just the beginning.
Right.
But how would you tie that? Are you saying that the character issue is the biblical writers are equating David in some sense to Saul, who was a little bit — I'm trying to understand how the comparing him physically puts David in question.
Because God doesn't care about physical appearance. And physical appearance is what fooled people about Saul.
Yeah, okay.
And now David is described in a way that it's like a Venn diagram. The descriptions significantly overlap. They're not exactly the same, but they overlap. So you're saying, okay, is this just the same mistake with a slightly different character?
Since Saul was positioned as maybe not the greatest of kings, then by describing David in the same way as Saul, you're kind of – you're potentially putting him already in that same bucket.
The writer's either saying, okay, here's somebody very different, or here's somebody who's pretty much the same. And I just want to suggest that as you read the story of David, you find someone who exhibits characteristics and character traits of Saul, but also is very different. You don't have a perfect character here. You have someone who is going to have flaws. Look for the flaws as you're reading this. And, you know, the Bathsheba incident, right? And there's some other things, too, that happen later on in the story, like the whole Philistine thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right, when he's he hangs out with Philistines for 18 months, the enemies, and he uses that to his political advantage. Maybe we'll get to that. That's a whole other story for another time.
Well, I think it ties here because, yeah, so later on in the story, which we don't want to give away too much, but David basically, I don't know if treason is too strong of a word, but he basically turns his back on the Judahites, at least the Israelites, or, you know, running away from Saul,
yeah,
and joins the Philistine army,
right?
Essentially, and I the only reason I bring that up or wanted to keep talking about that is because here in the 1 Samuel 17, you know, one of his other character flaws is kind of this. It's a little bit of an arrogance,
yeah,
but also a little bit of shadiness. Kind of like you can read this story in 1 Samuel 17 in such a way that David's really already kind of making these political moves. He's at least being strategic, maybe is a positive way of saying that.
Yeah. He's no innocent. He does not come across as somebody who's just innocently wanting to glorify God.
Right.
He doesn't come across. He comes across as someone who is thinking more strategically, and you could even say is interested in power at this point, right? Because he comes to the camp to, you know, he's going from his father's house in Bethlehem and coming down to basically give his older brother something to eat. He goes back and forth. That's sort of what his job is. And when he shows up and he hears Goliath raging on and on and on about what he's going to do and nobody wants to challenge me, blah, blah, blah. Then you get to like verses 24 to 30. Again, I can't stress this enough. Don't do this while you're driving, but just verses 24 to 30. you know, David shows up and the Israelites are talking to themselves and they say, you know, verse 24, have you seen this man? Verse 25, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come to defy Israel. That's Goliath. The king will greatly enrich the man who kills him and will give his daughter to make his family, give him his daughter to make his family free in Israel. So the person who defeats Goliath, Saul, is going to give him his daughter, which basically means you're going to be introduced to the royal family. That's not a small thing.
Yeah, you're going to become a prince.
Which means potentially, now Saul has his own sons, but potentially you could be in line to being king at that point. If the other, if an accident happens to the others, which seems to happen throughout the course of these stories.
Yeah, the you know? Everyone can't see your air quotes there.
Yeah, exactly.
The accidents that happen to people who are in line for the throne.
It's like the Sopranos. I might have to arrange an accident for you, you know, that kind of a thing. So, and it's sort of like you can read the story of David that way, that he's almost calculating. And so David shows up, and David said, verse 26, David said to the men who stood by him, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? The people answered him in the same way. In other words, they said the same thing again. So shall it be done for the man who kills him. And right then, his eldest brother Eliab shows up, and he heard him talking to the men. He sees David sort of, you know, in close quarters talking to these men about this stuff. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David. Interesting. He said, what are you doing here? You know, why have you come down? With whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil in your heart, for you have come down just to see the battle. And David said, I just love this part of the story. David said, well, what have I done now? I was only asking you a question. You know, he turned away from him toward another and spoke in the same way, and the people answered him again as before. So Eliab sort of confronts him and says, basically, I know you, little brother. What are you doing here? And I'm just asking a question. No, you're not. Are you just asking a question, David? Or are you asking a question? You know? And so he turns away from Eliab, his eldest brother, and he asks the same question again to the – now, what happens to the person who kills Goliath? So it looks – he knows exactly what he's getting himself into and what the consequences are. He's not just there to say, I need to defend our God's honor and I need to defend our people's honor. There's something going on here that he is actually on a quest for power. And I don't think that's overreading the text. That's there. And then the very fact that he marches into Saul's quarters and says, yeah, listen, I'll take care of this for you. Even to do that is really Saul's the one who should be fighting. Saul is the one who should be fighting because he's pretty tall too, right? He's not as tall as Goliath, but he's a tall man. He's the champion. He is abdicating his responsibility. For David to march in and say, I'll do it, that's a muted claim of kingship at that point.
Well, yeah, it's a muted claim of kingship on his part, but also from the writers of the story are positioning this in such a way that you ask that question. Why isn't the king, who should be the champion, facing Goliath? Maybe there's something wrong with this king, Saul. Maybe he's not doing what he should be as king. And here we have this, who is this young boy who seems to have more faith in God than Saul and has more courage? And so it is narratively, whatever the word would be, in the narrative, David is sort of being conniving, but the writers are a little bit endorsing this, who's this Saul guy again? And so they're kind of undermining Saul throughout this.
It's both, because it is definitely, you read this story and you say, Saul's not a good king at all. I mean, he's the one who should be on the front lines. But then you still have David showing up and saying, I'll do it. And his defense is, I've killed a lot of animals with my sling. And I'm going to do the same thing to this Philistine. And Saul's like, you're too young, you can't do this. And David basically talks him into it. And there is a bit of youthful bravado alongside with, let's say, this faith in God and his willingness to put his life on the line, so to speak, for defending God's honor and the people's honor. In other words, it's. I don't want to make the mistake. It's not either or.
Yeah,
it's not like David is negative, but David's both. You know, Saul is pretty much negative in these stories, period. But it's not like David is this pure angel that comes floating down to save the day. He's got something in his sights, and it looks like he's going after it at this point by presuming to march into Saul's tent as a teenager or whatever and say, I got this.
Yeah, what struck me just in reading this was, well, two things. One, it's interesting that the people, the Israelites, kind of are saying, the king is going to greatly enrich the man who kills him and will give him his daughter and make his family free in Israel. Just kind of offering this up. And then David's, you would expect it to be the other way around. I would expect David first to ask, what happens if you kill this Philistine? And then the answer is, the king will greatly enrich the man who kills him and you get to be a prince.
Mm-hmm.
But that's actually not how it is. Sort of, it could have puts that in question a little bit of David's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Tell me again. What's this? Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. You know, I get this picture of him just like, am I hearing that right? Like looking around like, really? If I do this, I get to be prince? Oh,
this is too good to be true.
Yeah. And then immediately his older brother, and for anyone who has older siblings kind of knows this, but yeah, his older brother's like, oh my gosh, I know David. And I know, like, I just imagine him kind of breaking up the crowd and is like, guys, don't listen to this guy.
Yeah, exactly right. He's just my stupid kid brother.
Exactly. I know. And just so the strong.
And then gives him a wedgie.
But the strength of his language is like,
yeah,
I know your presumption. I know that you have something, you have a scheme going on here.
Yeah.
Evil of your heart. Like, that's pretty strong.
You're always scheming, David. I grew up, yeah. you can't fool your family. You can fool these people, can't fool your family.
Exactly.
You're a flawed character. And, you know, not to go too far astray from this story, but, you know, you read commentaries on this, and I'll be very quick to pick out, like, a lot of this sounds like the Joseph story in Genesis, where the youngest brother basically hacks off the older brothers because of his arrogance, his cockiness, right? In that story, yep. Joseph is given this coat of many colors, again, whatever that means, but or the Technicolor dream coat, according to Broadway. But and that's a sign of his being favored by his father, Jacob. And so what does Joseph do? He goes out into the field where his brothers are working, says, yeah, basically, Dad loves me best. Look at the coat he gave me. Oh, by the way, I had a dream. One day you're all going to fall down and worship me. This is like – and what do? They throw him into a well, and that's how the story of Joseph begins, because you have this young cocky guy who has to learn humility, and that's part of what happens with David too. He actually matures. He's a complex moral figure, but he matures as the story goes on. And it's another, to me, it's another example of a whole other series of podcasts we could do, Jared, on how Genesis anticipates this monarchic period. There's a lot of David stuff going on in the book of Genesis, and this is one of those examples. So I think, again, it's another layer of just meaning and reflection on the part of these biblical writers to sort of tie a lot of this stuff together. I just find it fascinating, you know, so...
Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the U.S.? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Whatever you're interested in, they have it for you. Find the perfect fit for your climate and space. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. And along with their 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee, they offer free plant consultation forever.
I was worried about talking about fast-growing trees on here because I'm not a green thumb, but then I realized that probably makes me the perfect candidate to be able to talk about this. I loved the website. It was so easy. It was searchable by region. And then the experts who are there to help you make the decisions lowers the anxiety around something I don't typically know a lot about, but it was a really good experience.
This spring, they have the best deals online, up to half off on selected plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off their first purchase when using the code NORMALPEOPLE at checkout.
That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code NORMALPEOPLE at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code NORMALPEOPLE. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply.
Hey, everyone. My name is Amber G from California, and I'm part of the producers group here at the Bible for Normal People. One thing I've appreciated about this podcast is that there are other normal people who read their Bibles without using it as a weapon. I get to learn about many influential folks who act like Jesus without alienating large groups of people. If you have gotten something from this free podcast, I want to take a moment to mention how you can support Pete and Jared in their work. This podcast is brought to you by supporters on the Patreon platform. For as little as $1 a month, you can be part of this group that brings this podcast to normal people everywhere. As a gift for your support, we have book studies, chat groups, and lots of videos from Pete and Jared. So check it out at patreon.com/thebibleforNormalPeople. If you aren't able to support the show financially, go to iTunes and rate and review the podcast. That can go a long way to help others find us. One group in particular we want to thank is our producers group, who work hard to tell Pete and Jared where they're messing up and how to do better. Thanks to Shea Box, Lauren O'Connell, Chrissy Florence, Logan Jansen, Matt, Brad Harris, Ryan Morrison, and Martin Brightup. The Bible for Normal People couldn't happen without you. Now back to the podcast.
Well, let's go back and look a little bit at the text, because I think there's some interesting things going on here that you just... I remember, when we first reading these things, and as an adult, and even more recently, and being kind of kicking myself, like, oh my gosh, I remember seeing these things as a kid. But when you grow up in a tradition where you're not allowed to question the text, you're not allowed to have any doubts or say, like, wait a minute, I thought that, wait, that's not, 2 and 2 is not equaling 4 here. And now going back and kind of saying, oh, well, that makes me feel good. Like, I'm not going crazy. So maybe talk about a few of those, even kind of as we're introduced to David, there's some interesting discrepancies going on.
Yeah, very, very right here, you're introduced to things that just make you stop and think a little bit. Like, for example, people have picked up, this is a really obvious thing if you just read chapter 16 and 17 together. In chapter 16, David is anointed king. It's a private ceremony. It's just, David and Samuel and the family, I guess. But the Spirit of God comes on David. And then we read that God sends an evil spirit to Saul, basically making him, it sounds like he's depressed or maybe bipolar or something like that. That's the behavior he seems to exhibit here. That's what some people say that anyway. But the thing is that, there's no medication, there's no therapy, but he needs music to soothe him. And so you have one of his people say, I know of this guy. He's a son of Jesse in Bethlehem. He's skillful in playing a lyre, just sort of like a harp kind of thing, And he's skillful in playing. He's also a man of valor. Now listen to this. He's a man of valor, a warrior, prudent in speech, and a man of good presence, and the Lord is with him. I mean, that's a weird thing to say of David before he's done anything to call him a warrior. Well, again, that's the writer signaling where some of this story is going to go. It's anachronistic to call David a warrior now when he's a kid and he hasn't done anything warrior-like. And that alone is just an interesting thing to think about. But here's the thing. David plays the lyre for Saul. Saul feels better. And so at that point, David enters Saul's service. And he's living with Saul. And he is playing the lyre. Whenever Saul gets upset, David plays the lyre. And it soothes him. And so he was introduced as a pretty important person in Saul's court. That's how David makes his way into the court, right? But now the David and Goliath story, basically, you get to a point in the story where it's like, we've never heard of him before. Who is this David? In other words, he's introduced a second time as, in verse 12, now David was a son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had 8 sons. Yeah, we know this. And here, Saul is very old, and what David did is, he was the youngest of his brothers, and he would go back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep in Bethlehem, and then he would go down, to feed his brothers, right? So he was going like back and forth and not really stable in one place, like in Saul's court. And it's like, where is he? And why are we being introduced to David a second time? We read this already in chapter 16. David is introduced. Now he's introduced a second time as if we've never heard of the guy. And it seems like nobody knows who he is, because you get to the end of the story of David and Goliath, and that's in 17:55 and 58. These are the last few verses. And after David is victorious, Saul saw David go out against the Philistine. He said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this young man?" Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I don't know." The king said, "Inquire whose son this stripling is." On David's return from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of Philistine in his hand. Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David said, "I'm the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." I was like, how can Saul not know who he is? This is a discrepancy. I mean, however you explain it, that, you know, probably multiple explanations, but most people think like you have here a discrepancy that suggests you have two – this is how biblical scholars talk. You have two David traditions that are edited together in these two stories and sort of made to fit, but the fit is very uneasy.
So just like we have two creation stories, so you have two kind of creation traditions – in Genesis 1:1 through 2:4, and then 2:4 through 3, and an editor has come and kind of combined these and tried to harmonize these in some way. Not even harmonize, I'm not going to put it that way, but edited them together.
Yeah, because he respects the traditions.
Right, yeah, he respects the traditions. That's why I didn't want to harmonize, because I think there's something to kind of keeping two traditions alive
right.
in this.
Right.
And here we see David, we see in the David and Goliath story, or at least the beginning of David's story here in 16 and 17, we see a similar editing where every once in a while you kind of get this sense that we're starting the story over.
Right.
Just like if you read Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, you feel like, oh, wait, I thought we already did this. And it feels like you're starting it over because in some senses you are.
You are.
And so with that, you know, it makes very little sense, just to summarize what you're saying, that in all of chapter 16, David seems to be on very intimate terms with Saul as his medication
yeah.
for this evil spirit. And so you would imagine there would be lots of interactions. At the very least, very common in the ancient world would be to know whose son you are.
Right, right.
And so that's kind of how you introduce yourself. And so it seems very bizarre here at the end of 17 for Saul to say, whose son is this young man? And then for Abner, the commander of the army not to know. So you have two people
right.
who have no idea.
I mean,
who
that's
this person
the key
is.
Because you could always say, well, the reason Saul doesn't know it is because he's a complete moron.
Yeah, right.
Which makes him a
or
bad
he's
king.
Super sick, you know, or mental health yeah. or whatever.
Or that
yeah.
evil spirit that God put on him
exactly.
is like incapacitating him. But Abner doesn't know either. They clearly are like, they're watching this battle, and here's this young guy, and they don't know who he is. Like, this guy came out of nowhere, you know, and.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, it's just, it's at least interesting. You know, this is like a fissure in the text, a fissure in the story that makes you, well, it doesn't make everybody ask this question, but if you're interested in things like the literary integrity of a story, these things jump out at you. If it's in the Bible or in any other piece of literature, you would say something weird is going on here. It's like I'm reading two different stories at some point. And, you know, for people, this is, you know, a lot of what biblical scholarship does is it asks questions of origins, like where do these stories come from and who put them together like this, right? And that's the question that a lot of people have too, just, you know, normal people reading the Bible, like you said, when you were young, just noticing things, but we're not allowed to ask them. That's a bad thing.
Another example of that is when you look up in 2 Samuel 21 there, we have the question of who actually killed Goliath.
Yeah.
So in 2 Samuel 21, we have Elhanan killing Goliath. And yet here in 1 Samuel 17, it's David who kills Goliath. And interestingly enough, then you get to Chronicles, which is really a retelling of the Samuel King's story and written much later in chapter 20. You can see them trying to like make sense of this, because in that verse, they have Elhanan killed Lami, the brother of Goliath.
Right.
Even though, and it says, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam, which is the same description you get
right
earlier. So they're yeah. really struggling here to make sense of who killed Goliath, because in the tradition that they're working from, we have David and we have Elhanan, and so they have to sort of figure this out somehow.
Yeah, what some people think is exactly that. You've got these two traditions, and then Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, tries to mediate between them and harmonize them a little bit, because that he does that a lot, this writer of First and Second Chronicles. But you know, you've got this Elhanan in Second Samuel, who is said to kill Goliath, and again, that weaver's beam, you know, is the same description that we find in 1 Samuel 17 in the David and Goliath story. So people say it's the same person. So who did it? And pretty much, like, you know, this is the answer you'll get from most people who study this, is that, okay, the Elhanan tradition is actually accurate. Or this is the one that, you know, he did something, because Elhanan is one of the great mighty fighting men that are listed at the end of 2 Samuel, and this is one of his deeds. And that deed was sort of, by the writer, lifted off of Elhanan and placed on David to magnify and idealize David as a figure without needing to correct, you know, without trying to cover up what he's doing, because these writers and editors weren't idiots. They knew that it was Elhanan in 2 Samuel and David in 1 Samuel. They knew the discrepancy as much as anybody else. But there's probably a reason why David is given that honor of having killed Goliath and not just one of his fighting men, because you're presenting a picture of David at the very early stages of his career as being someone who is very, very brave and very competent as a warrior, unlike Saul. He's a very competent warrior. But there you have it. I mean, it's just it's right there, and you got to deal with it somehow.
Maybe we're asking each other the wrong – maybe I'm asking the wrong person. You're not a historian in that sense, but I wonder if that was, it seems like that would be pretty common when you start to kind of mythologize, or, you know, you want to posture your kings in the best possible light, that sort of what happens to the king's men happens to the king.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have this, I just wonder if that would have been a more common practice. I could imagine it, given all the propagandistic way that stories were told in the ancient world, that you would maybe often attribute these wonderful deeds maybe done by the king's men as though the king himself did it.
And using the word propaganda is key. And I know that's not a word that all of our listeners will feel comfortable using of portions of the Bible, but it is regularly used of this section of the Bible, talking about David especially. It seems like this whole story seems like a propping David up, a pro-David story, but still dealing with some of the dark side. You can't ignore the dark side. It's there. But at the end of the day, basically, David was awesome. And he was a champion. And he was a man after God's own heart. Yeah, the whole Bathsheba thing, we get it. But still, apart from that, in terms of the worship of Yahweh, he was a man after God's own heart. He didn't stray from that.
Well, and I want to point that out, because if we can hear toward the end of this podcast, talk a little bit about the implications of this. Because I know for people who feel like they've been scandalized because they didn't get to see the kind of the dark underbelly of David because their religious tradition didn't emphasize those parts of the Bible, I think for me, the real scandal, or the real interesting thing, is that it is there.
Yeah, we're not making it up.
In the Bible. Like, there are a lot of political traditions, ancient history writing, where you would have whitewashed that. You would have not have left no trace of your kings having these questionable deeds in their life, and here in the Bible. So for me, it's more surprising that we actually have those in the text, and the Bible seems to be okay with that.
Right, which is a telling bit of information in terms of the fact that, and if anything, they were not trying to satisfy purely like intellectual historical curiosities. It wasn't just, let's get the story straight, what actually happened. That's a modern question. They had traditions and they were bringing them together. They were trying to respect them as much as possible. They were very minimalist in changing traditions to make things fit. They left them there and they put them together. And sometimes the way they put them together reveals these what we will call problems, right? Like, who killed Goliath, right? How can David be introduced twice? But that's a very modern bias. And we walk into the Bible expecting it not to do those things because it's God's word. And God would never do this to us. Well, God's doing it to you. So there you – what are you going to do?
And I trust that a little more. Like, there's something nice and more trustworthy to me about a Bible that will retain these traditions that have, if not contradictory, sometimes contradictory, but if not also just challenging or different trajectories or different ways of telling the story, rather than, again, I feel like for me, my tradition being Southern Baptist growing up, like, we weren't okay with what the Bible itself does. Like, somehow we needed it to all say the same thing and not have different traditions, when the Bible itself doesn't do that. And frankly, I'm more comfortable with a Bible that does that because it feels more authentic and it's not simply propagandistic. There's self-critiquing in there. There's conflicting stories. And so I think that's actually something, not a problem with the Bible. And that's kind of how, I guess what I'm saying is, I think we've thought of those as problems. Like if you look up the Skeptic's Bible and they'll like point out these, who killed Goliath? Was it Elhanan or was it David? Aha, gotcha.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, no, it doesn't have to be a gotcha. That's the traditions coming together. And I appreciate that they present you with both of those traditions.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, there are a couple more little things that we can mention that I think are interesting and see if this helps anybody, you know, wrap their heads around this story like we're trying to. But in chapter 17, again, this is where we are. And in verses 50 and 51, it really looks as if Goliath is killed twice. And it's a really odd phrasing. So you read, so David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, striking down the Philistine and killing him. There was no sword in David's hand. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine. He grasped his sword, drew it out of his sheath, and killed him. Then he cut off his head with it. So the question is, did David kill him with a sling, or did David kill him with the sword? It says both. Now, some of you who have a Bible open in front of you, you might say, well, there's no problem here because my Bible doesn't say that he killed him with a sword. It says that he finished him off with the sword. But it doesn't say that, actually. It says he killed him twice. And the question is, was it with a sling or was it with a sword? And, you know, maybe this is one of these, I don't know, we don't have footnotes here to tell us how to read this stuff. You have to sort of like figure it out and try to make sense of it. The way I always looked at this is that it's not really so much a discrepancy as it is very intentional on the part of the writer, because David, in killing him with a sling, which is the weapon of a shepherd, but he's also killing him with a sword, which is the weapon of a king.
Right. We see a transformation of David from shepherd boy to king in this event.
Right. Now, some say, well, this is more evidence of two traditions. That may be true. I don't lose a moment's sleep over that. But there's something appealing too about the artisticness of this, like side by side, putting it like this. We're seeing a transition moment.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
But maybe one more just that I'll mention because, you know, we're here. Let's knock a few of these off. But yeah. in 17 and in 54, this is the end of the story. You know, the Goliath is dead and they're routing the Philistines. And then the Israelites came back from chasing the Philistines and they plundered their camp. David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. I guess David has a tent. He's bringing food for his brothers, but I guess he's got to stay someplace. But that sounds a bit royal almost, like he has his tent. He puts his armor in his tent. That's what a king does, by the way. You take the armor of the vanquished, you put it in your tent. But what's really interesting is that he took the head of Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem. This is a big problem in terms of the chronology of the text, because we're in 1 Samuel 17. Jerusalem isn't even a thing until 2 Samuel 5. A bunch of chapters later, after David is king, he captures Jerusalem and makes it the capital. There is no Jerusalem. Jerusalem is now it's run by non-Israelites, Jebusites.
This isn't the capital that we would think of it at the time. It's actually not even an Israelite city.
Exactly.
So it makes no sense for David at this point in the story to take it to Jerusalem.
Right. So it's just like, you know, what's going on there? Is this a It's sort of like calling David a warrior way back in chapter 16 when he's just a shepherd who's going to play his harp, right? He's a great warrior. You're anticipating something. And by mentioning Jerusalem in this, you're signaling to the readers where the story is going and ultimately what is happening here. David is very kingly at this moment. He's already king. in Jerusalem now, even though he's not, right? But it's an interesting discrepancy that I think, like Goliath being killed twice, it's a discrepancy that may have more like literary and theological explanations than David being introduced twice, for example. I think those are different kinds of problems. But even so, it's just, you know, it's a multi-layered story. And, you know, just one thing, I hope this is helpful, and I'll throw this out, you know, Jared, I don't know if we want to riff on this a little bit, but all these things, all these discrepancies that we're mentioning here, they happen basically between verses 12 and 31. And then starting in verse 55 again, these are where the discrepancies occur in the story. In the Greek version of the David and Goliath story, all that is missing. Now, let's not freak out here a little bit. Let's just back up a little bit and sort of talk about what's going on here. There came a point in time in Israel's history, this is about a couple hundred years before Jesus, where Greek became the dominant culture, and so the Hebrew Bible was translated into Greek so people could actually understand it, because they weren't speaking Hebrew as much anymore. And that's called the Septuagint. That's the, you know, the technical scholarly term, but it's the Greek translation. And there's something about this Greek translation that only has part of the story. David is not introduced twice in the Greek version. And it's not like at the end where Abner and Saul have no idea who he is. That's not in the Greek tradition. So you have a version of the Hebrew, a version of the David and Goliath story out there that's very, very old, that only represents one of these two traditions. Is that confusing? Jared, talk to me. Does this make any sense, or should we follow up on this a little bit?
No, I think it makes sense. My question would be, why do you think that is?
Why do I think that is because, well, why do I think this is? This is the thing people debate. But do we have an hour more? Because I would really like to talk about this. But okay, I'll give the tweet version of it. The Greek translation of the Hebrew David and Goliath story, that Hebrew that it was taken from is a different Hebrew tradition than the Hebrew tradition we have in our Bible. Our Bible has both of those brought together, but there was another Hebrew version of this story. This isn't just a problem with Greek translators deciding they want to leave stuff out. They're right. Actually dependent on a whole other tradition of Hebrew that goes back who knows how long. And this is not the only example of this we have in the Bible. There are other big examples, whole books of the Bible that seem to work this way. And the whole point is this, is just, you know, these stories have complex origins and they have complex histories of development and even of evolution. Just like if you've ever like studied folklore, or how nursery rhymes work or anything, they change over time. They get told and told and told again. And sometimes they get versions get stuffed together. Sometimes they get separated out. When you're dealing largely with oral cultures, this is the kind of thing that's going to happen. You're going to have these different versions floating around. And this, you know, there are some Jews living at a certain point of time, a few hundred years before Jesus, who basically respected all these traditions and put them together in this sacred text that we now call the Bible.
Okay, so I want to go back to something you said earlier, and then I want to maybe try to summarize what you were saying there. Just when we're talking about the literary, when we have David taking the head of Goliath to Jerusalem, I think we find that in several places in the Bible. And the first thing that came to my mind was in the book of Jonah. I think in the first or second chapter, there are not many chapters to choose from there, you have the people on the boat making sacrifices to God. And I always think of that. And you also have this sense in which they're like right by the temple, where there's like no way, there's no way you're making sacrifices on a boat.
Right.
So right in the middle of this thing that seems historical, or it's trying to at least tell somewhat of a narrative or a story of that's believable, you have this somewhat outrageous thing happening. And it makes you sort of stop and think. Like, I could have just imagined, you know, if you're reading closely, that's kind of my point, is when we started this, we were talking about, this isn't about saying gotcha moments to the Bible. It's actually saying, if we look closely, this is a very nuanced and sophisticated book. And we have here this code of David taking the head to Jerusalem. And that's supposed to signal something It's not supposed to, just like in Jonah, when they're making sacrifices on the boat, you're not supposed to say, that's ludicrous. Who would ever make sacrifices on a wooden boat in the middle of the ocean?
These aren't incidental details.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that, yeah, they're not incidental. And they're there for a reason. And they're not there for you to poke fun at the Bible. They're there to say, oh, there's something significant about this. What might it be? And it sort of helps you, it points you in the direction of where the text is going and what it's trying to say. So anyway, we just have examples of that all over the Bible, and I think it's important because it's easy to dismiss these things and be kind of, I think, what C.S. Lewis called, like, have that chronological snobbery.
Right.
Where somehow we're super smart and sophisticated, and they were really dumb. But so I want to kind of oversimplify what you said about the tradition with the Septuagint or the Greek translation. So if I'm oversimplifying to the point that it's grossly inaccurate, you can let me know. But just thinking of, I think sometimes people think, well, there's like one Hebrew book that's called the Old Testament, and then some folks who spoke Greek and Hebrew were like, oh, we should translate this for the Greek people. And that's not the case. There were, and again, this is where I'll oversimplify, but when you say tradition, I think in people's minds, it might be easy to say there were maybe multiple versions of the book, and the Greek people who translated it had one version of the book, but there were other versions out there. Would that be a fair way to say that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the again, to speaking as historians, which is what a lot of modern people are when they read the Bible, the Bible that we have in front of us, this is a whole other podcast and series too, but the Bible we have in front of us has a history. It didn't just pop out of nowhere. It developed over time. We're just catching things pretty late in the process. We're not seeing the origins of anything. And we catch glimpses of it when we look at things like this Greek translation. Like, why is it different? Well, how do we explain the differences between this Greek version, which is missing half the story, the half that's the problem? You know, it seems to have one of these traditions, one of these versions of the David and Goliath story that it took as, well, this is the story, but others had others. And you combine them at some certain point later on when both of these traditions are really old and, let me even say, sacred and venerated, and you want to hold on to them. And that's why the Bible that we have is really a work of editing as much as anything, of people putting things together and, you know, learned people who are trying to capture the history and the essence of who they are as a people. And you bring your tradition along with you. And the fact that these things cause contradictions is more of a problem for a modern mindset than for an ancient one. They just didn't think that way. It didn't bother them that, well, we can't do this because there's a little discrepancy. Let's clear this up because some modern, you know, Westerners are going to not like this in a few thousand years. It's just, we have to step into those ancient.
Yeah. How dare they not think that way?
Yeah, exactly. They didn't think like us. The world has not been like us since forever. And I think respecting the text is about not trying to cover up these things, but trying to understand them. And as a result, I think coming to maybe a deeper understanding of, well, what is the Bible and how does it work and how do we read it? You know, we're not the first ones to do that.
Well, I think that's a perfect segue as we come to the end of our time.
You think so? Can I say one more thing? Because no. This will blow people away.
No, it better be amazing if you're gonna.
It is amazing.
Past that ending point there.
Okay, Goliath is 6 cubits and a span, which a cubit is 1.5 feet. So 6 cubits and a span is 9 foot 9 inches, which is very tall. That's in the Hebrew. The Greek version has him 4 cubits and a span. So he's basically 6'9". And people say the Septuagint is right. He's not 10 feet tall. He's probably more like 6.5 feet tall. So that's another thing the Septuagint does, is sort of brings Goliath down to size. Now, I'm sorry. If I saw somebody 6'9" coming at me with a spear, I'd run. I mean, I know people who are that tall, and I'm afraid of them. They can hurt me.
Right. Much. You don't need to be 9 foot tall to make that scary.
Right. Especially if you're a teenager who's used to tending sheep. But anyway. Yeah, Man, we're scratching the surface, folks. This is just so much fun to look at this stuff this way. But it raises the question of what is the Bible and what do we do with it? It really does.
All right. Thanks, folks, for listening to this episode of The Bible for Normal People. If you want to keep the conversation going about this and all kinds of stuff, there's all kinds of conversations happening on Slack if you wanted to go to patreon.com/thebible for normal people, or just head over to pedens.com or thebibleformalpeople.com, and there's lots of blogs and articles and things to engage with there as well. So hopefully we can keep going on these interesting, fascinating stories about the Bible that maybe we've never heard before.
Absolutely. And thanks for listening, folks. As always, we appreciate when you download and press play. It means a lot.
Yep. See you next time.
See ya.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.